Hi everyone, this is Kevin Chen from Experian Data Lab. This is what happens when machine meets world.
Live from Infinia ML, this is Machine Meets World. And now, here's your host, James Kotecki.
Hello, it is Machine Meets World. We are back for the year 2022. And I'm very excited to welcome our first guest, Kevin Chen, who is the Chief Scientist, North America Experian Data Labs, which is part of Experian. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, James. Thank you for inviting me into the show.
And Kevin, we pointed out your background as kind of the colors of the company. It's very artful. So I think people who are seeing the video version of this, not the podcast, can appreciate that.
Indeed. If anyone is familiar with Experian, or if you go to our website, you will see this is pretty much the color scheme of the company.
So I think we should probably start there with Experian itself, because many people will be watching this or listening to this and maybe have some notion of Experian overall as a company. Can you just kind of define quickly what that is, but really what your role in the company is, what Experian Data Labs actually does separate from the overall company?
Sure. So when it comes to Experian, especially for the folks in North America, in the US, you probably would think that Experian is one of the three credit bureaus, because that's what you interact with in your daily life. As a matter of fact, Experian is much more than that. First of all, Experian is a global company. We actually have presence in 44 countries with various capacities. We actually have, first of all, Experian is a data and analytics technology company. We not only serve as credit bureau in many regions, we are B2B, we're also B2C. We actually have various business units in each of the regions. For example, in North America, we have Consumer Information Bureau, which is for the credit bureau that you're familiar with. We also have Business Credit Bureau, that's essentially the counterpart for the commerce, right? We also have targeting business units, that's for doing online and offline marketing. And then we also have auto, have information about consumers' auto and ownership and so on. We also have healthcare that helps hospitals to improve their revenue cycle and so on. And the last one, we also have what we call decision analytics that helps the company to make decisions on analytics as well as fraud detections.
Yeah.
So you ask about
it's definitely a huge scope of work that Experian's up to.
It is a very wide scope, obvious because everybody is much more familiar with credit bureau, but it really covered a lot of areas. So you ask about Data Lab. Data Lab is actually the R&D arm of Experian. We are founded about 11 years ago, and then starting from that point, we have grown into four labs globally. In North America, we are based in San Diego. That's where I'm right now. And we also have a data lab in UK, in London, and Sao Paulo, and also in Asia Pacific, in Singapore, for each of the regions there. So being an R&D, what we do is not really doing the day-to-day product development. Rather, we're looking at what we call Horizon 2 and Horizon 3 opportunities. Those are the opportunities or the phenomena that's going to be disruptive for the industry in the, say, the next 3, 5, even 10 years. That's going to impact or improve our business as well as our clients' business significantly. So we look into these kind of problems and try to tackle them.
Yeah. Okay. And Horizon 2 and Horizon 3, that just those phrases, as opposed to, I guess, Horizon 1, maybe Horizon 1 is what you can actually see with the naked eye. Horizon 2 and 3, it's a little bit harder to figure out what's kind of coming next.
It's hard to figure out. You pretty much know what, you have some idea about what that is, but it's not necessarily well defined, and people are tackling from different directions. You may not even have a solution just yet.
So this is a show where we talk to thought leaders in AI. So we're having you on to talk about a component of that. And speaking of definitions, let's start there. Kind of how do you define AI for the work that you're doing, especially since that work is looking at the future, not necessarily the present of where the technology is?
Right. So AI, as we all know, as it evolved in the past 20 years, AI really is trying to understand the data and learn from the data and then come up with the algorithm and eventually come up with the algorithm in order to solve the problem, right? And that's what the machine learning is about. And that's what, at least currently what AI is about. Now, from an experience point of view, we are actually all about that because we are trying to unlock the power of data, right? So we're trying to figure out what's the meaning of the data, trying to figure out how that reflects the consumer's financial behavior, the demographic information, and how that can be used to improve or create opportunities for the people and for the business. And the way that we tackle it, at Experian, we really wanted to use the data for good, right? So we're trying to figure out how to use the data to improve the people's life. For example, in the lab here, we actually help our business unit, actually help our credit bureau to devise a new algorithm or new score using AI and new data as well, trying to help. What we found out is we were able to help about additional 50 million more consumers to be so-called financially included. Because those 50 million consumers in the past, they either are not necessarily scorable by the credit bureau because they are lack of necessary information, or they are essentially just what we call financial invisible, credit invisible. The reason is those people are most likely cash finance, cash economy. They use cash. They are likely to be immigrants or minority and so on. So they are left out sort of in this economy. And by using AI, we're actually able to bring them back to give them opportunity there.
So I'd like to dive into that example just for a second, because I think it's illustrative. There is a, I'm sure that when people hear credit or credit bureau, I know that that's not just all you're doing, but when people hear Experian is using AI, the pessimists will go right away towards, it's potentially being used to exclude people, or the algorithm is going to say that I'm not credit worthy. You're saying that the opposite is actually true, that you can actually use AI to bring more people into the system.
Definitely.
What I'm curious about is what data are you looking at that presumably in the past a human or maybe a more rudimentary computer-based system was looking at that or what didn't have access to or just couldn't kind of understand, in quotation marks, what that data meant. But now with AI, you're able to look at some data in a new way. What is that data you're getting from these 15 million new folks?
So these are like data like, for example, your rental data, things like that, right? Rental, those are the kind of data that's not used in the past, for example.
Interesting.
Now, yeah. And, as you mentioned earlier, not only credit, right? We also actually do a large part in terms of fraud detection, right? So we help the financial institutions to identify, identity theft. And, because the fraudsters tend to steal people's identity and commit fraud, and we help consumers to identify those scenarios as well. Yeah.
Do you think about the data in terms of its kind of human analog as far as being documents? Because, if we put this to a human analogy of like, what was it like before machines got that involved in it? It's people sitting around looking at paper documents, trying to assess an overall picture of a person's creditworthiness or fraud or other things like that. And now, obviously, documents get digitized, data gets more kind of flowable and usable. But is it still useful in some way for Experian to think in terms of that unit of kind of documents, like that rental agreement that you talked about?
There's a lot of information on the document, right? But I think not only the information on the document, but also your behavior, whether you're consistent, whether you're fulfilling your rental agreement, just to give an example. Right. So essentially what we look at is not a one-time snap, look at just a single document, but it could be, various documents over time to see how you evolve to reflect whether you are fulfilling your financial obligation or not.
Right. Different data points over time show the pattern.
Different data points over time.
So let's pivot to, or maybe not pivot, maybe just evolve the conversation into a topic I know that you're really interested in, which is no-code AI. So I gather that you're getting to kind of the interface between people that might want to use some of this technology to do things like detect fraud, to expand creditworthiness, but aren't necessarily data scientists themselves. So before we get into kind of what this means technically at Experian, can you just kind of tell me your reasons for caring about this in the first place? What's the problem that it's solving?
So there's actually multiple reasons, right? Personally, I've been looking into how to help, how to use machine to understand the people better, right? How to create this interface to understand what people meant through the natural language, for example. And as you know, there has been significant improvement tremendous breakthrough in the deep learning field, in the AI, that allow the machine to understand, for example, natural language in the recent years, right? I believe it was 2017, the seminal papers, Attention is All You Need, that introduced the so-called transformer that created this gigantic foundation model that started to learn from massive amount of corpus to understand people's human language and being able to complete a lot of tasks. So that's why I feel it's time, prime for us to start figuring out whether we can leverage technology like this in order to help non-technical people, like you pointed out, to benefit from AI, if you will, right? And then from the company perspective, it's also critical in the sense that, as I mentioned earlier, the company is a data and analytics company. So we actually provide these data, the refined data and the analytics to our clients for them to make decisions, right? And right. So the counterparty on the client side, they will be trying to understand, trying to explore, trying to uncover how to use the data, how to use the analytics. And we wanted to see whether we can help those non-technical people, for example, the product managers, or not non-technical analysts who are wanting to do fraud detection, how we can help them to analyze the data without really having to rely on people like me, data scientists, mm-hmm. right? So that they can do it themselves. So that's pretty much the motivation there.
If I think about this from the science fiction perspective of kind of flashing forward to a future where this exists and it works perfectly, am I imagining a scenario where someone just says to a computer, someone just says like, okay, figure out why all of my customers who left my business last year, figure out why they all left, look at all these comments that they left, look at all these reviews and just kind of figure out what's going on with my customer base. And that's it's a super vague question, right? Now a human could answer that and would probably know intuitively some of those things. There may not be a program designed to do that, but then it's almost like the computer is writing a computer program to do that. And so is that the kind of dream state, the utopia here?
That's the dream state, to be honest, right? You mentioned about science fiction. I like to watch sci-fi movies, right? So Avengers, Marvel movies. It's kind of a bonding time for me and my kids. Jarvis, as everybody knows, right? So in the Avenger for Tony Stark, yeah. The way that Jarvis is able to understand and try to come up with ideas and execute on it on his own, I think that's going to be the dream state.
Yeah. So tell me about how close we are right now. I know you're working in a lab, you're working at the Horizon 2 and 3 levels. So what have you got so far that you can talk about in terms of how close we actually are?
I would say we're making progress in the sense that we are able to create some kind of interface and being able to understand the human's intention to a certain degree. Now, it's not always correct. And some kind of prep as I mentioned earlier, because machine learning, as we know, need to learn from the data. So you need to somehow prep with some kind of data, try to train a model, mm-hmm. but it's making progress. Now, the Jarvis state that I mentioned, I would say probably still another 10 years in the mm-hmm. sense that really, we're not talking about just purely understand the mechanics that the human needs, but also the subtle details, right? What's the human's preference? Some of the common knowledge, common sense, how to bring those all together into this mix. I think that's still a little bit far away, but I think we're getting the head start.
Yeah, well, I've seen those Marvel movies. I don't think we're ready for Jarvis yet as a society. No. I think we need to kind of catch up to where the technology might be socially. So, but can we talk in terms of like how this might look for a client today or maybe in just a couple of years? Some other examples of things that they might use kind of no-code AI to be able to accomplish.
Right. So, sure. So, for no-code AI, right, the way that we're thinking about is, as you mentioned earlier, we wanted to enable the non-technical people to use it, right? So these are typically people who are, for example, product managers, sales, for example, or store owners, they wanted to be able to look at the data and then try to make some decision. But oftentimes, at least as of right now, oftentimes if they have the access to data scientists or analysts, they probably would ask those people to do the analysis and create a model for them. And then this is going to be more like an iterative process, right? Because think about the non-technical people, they may not have all the idea, all the requirement in the beginning. So this could be an iterative process, talk to the data scientists, explore the data, and then come back and forth and then try to refine it.
Right.
Now, with the no-code AI, we may actually have the opportunity to put the decision maker into the driver's seat on the data so that they have a more intimate relationship with the data. They can potentially talk to this, what we call no-code conversational agents that potentially you'll be able to just talk to it and say, hey, tell me what's my revenue trend over the past 2 years, given that COVID happened, right? And then you probably can start from there and say, hey, you know what? Tell me what are the stores that's not really doing well, and then can you contrast it to the one that's doing really well, and then started to drive dive in and then say, how's that compared to my competitors, for example, right? And if we have some data at our disposal, maybe you can say, hey, can you bring some COVID data, COVID cases data, or some social distance data, mobility data, right? How that correlate to the visit to my stores, whether that's the main impact or there's something else. And then store owner may be able to say, hey, you know what? Then I got some idea, maybe I want to test it out. Can you make some prediction based on some of my hypothesis and then try to build a model for it? So I think that could be one example.
That makes a lot of sense. And I was wondering if in the interim period between the perfect Jarvis and kind of where we are now, there aren't some interim steps here where it's not as if you take the data scientist out of the loop entirely, but maybe that can be a more junior data scientist, or maybe one data scientist can now service multiple clients, whereas before they were only able to do analysis on one client because it just took so much time. Is that kind of the interim step that we're going to see as we kind of move forward here?
Totally. And, you know, even the example I gave you, right? I don't think, you know, to your point, at this state, you don't want to trust the output of the no-code AI entirely, right? Because you probably need to have someone to validate it. And you, the idea you have, to me, it's probably a prototype at best, right? And then I think what you're driving to the human in loop, essentially, right? You have some human in the back, which helpfully have more knowledge with data science background and help, and that's able to help you to correct the error and then to make the model more perfect. I think that's the right idea.
Yeah. Let's talk about what the humans are doing on the back end to make this work. So when we talk about no code, it doesn't mean that there's actually no code. It just means that the end user is not necessarily needing to understand the code or use the code or even think about it in terms of code, because to them, it's just a conversational or relatively straightforward interface. So I guess my question is, does the fact that it's no code on the front end, does that change the way that you think about creating the code on the back end? If you're creating something that's ultimately supposed to be no code, does that change the design decisions that go into it from the start?
Yeah, I think you can look at this from several aspects, right? First of all, to your point, no code is not really no code. You actually need to have a lot more codes in the back, right? And we're talking about AI. This is no code AI. It's not no code for implementing a website. It's really no code for enabling you to do the AI. So to me, you need to have AI to do this AI, right? Mm. So you need to be able to have the intelligence to execute some of the tasks that can be used for AI. So, you know, think about this. When we talk about AI machine learning, really it's talking about how you're able to not only ingest the data, how you're able to look at the data to understand the quality, to even to do some kind of cleansing, and then generate what we call features, right? That can really be used to uncover the importance of the data and then try to tackle the problem you have. So all these require intelligence. Now the issue, as you pointed out, as we have this so-called no-code AI, in the front end, you have someone that really not necessarily have all the necessary knowledge, right? Those are the non-technical people. So in the backend, even if you implement all those technical modules, those AI modules, how do you make the right choice? Because you need to somehow make certain right choice for the user. You may not be able to make all the choices for the user, but you need to make some. So how do you intelligently make those choices? I think that actually become very important, right?
Yeah, and as the training goes on, I assume you need to be bringing in those subject matter experts with you to say, yes, you know, in different testing scenarios, or even just to provide the initial data based on how they would have looked at a problem, that's probably what the machine needs to train on.
Totally. And, you know, back to the human interface, right? So, and because we encountered this, you are trying to interface with someone that have no technical background. So the requirement or the command from the user tend to be not very specific. For example, if the consumer says, "Hey, can you tell me what's the how am I doing as compared to my competitors?" Yeah. So what do you mean by how am I doing, right? So are you talking about my revenue? Are you talking about my number of customers? Do I, you know, throw everything at you and then let you have a look? You know, so how do I decide what information to share with you? And how do I subtly ask for some hint from a user and then say, hey, you know, are you looking for this, not that? And how do you remember that in the past, you normally look at this and maybe this is what I'm going to present you first, right?
For this particular user, actually, this is what they usually want.
For this particular user, there you go. Yeah. So I think there's a lot of intelligence that need to be brought into this.
Right? Yeah, I mean, I can imagine a scenario where the user gets frustrated because you throw everything, or you say, you say, please specify precisely. And they're like, I don't want to do that. But maybe there's a middle ground where you're like, and you know, you're presenting, you say, most people who ask that question are looking at these three metrics. Is one of these three metrics the answer, or do you want to specify? So then hopefully it gets them, you know, a little bit closer. And there's a lot of interesting things you can do with UX here to make it friendlier, that aren't necessarily like hardcore AI decisions, but that are more like human psychological decisions that we have to kind of deal with our messiness, right?
Exactly. So this HCI is really not that easy to implement.
I want to go to the what I'm calling the lightning rounds of the conversation. Very exciting. Okay. Just quick answers to these. These are just kind of open-ended questions. Your quick answers will be great. What's a question that people might not realize that their data can answer? And I know these are potentially general questions, but go ahead and take that however you want.
Their data cannot. What
is a question that people might not realize that their data can answer for them?
Sometimes data simply just don't have the right information. Because I think as a data scientist, you do need to find the right data, right? So, yeah.
So do you find that people are often, asking questions to their data that it can't answer, rather than the opposite, which is they're not thinking creatively enough about the right questions to ask?
I think it's both. If you find a creative way to ask the data, then you may be able to construct the right features out of the data that can help you to answer the question that you're trying to find. But if the data you have at hand truly have no intersection with what the kind of problem you're trying to address, then it's a no-no, right?
Yeah. These are maybe esoteric philosophical questions. So you're actually helping us vet these, because this is the first time we've asked these specific questions, but I appreciate you being game for this. Do you think there's a question that we will be able to ask businesses, let's just say, is there a question that businesses will be able to ask their data in the future that they can't ask it right now?
The same kind of data?
Do you think that there's going to be something where we'll be able to get more answers or ask more questions of the same data set in the future?
I think that's possible. As we have seen historically, right? The same kind of data, in the past, people may only be able to explore to a certain degree, whether it's a lack of a technology or lack of the computation power. But now with, you know, for example, deep learning and so on, you're able to actually explore some features, some hidden information that's never been able to explore in the past. It's just surface, right? So I think it's possible, totally possible.
Yes. Is there an example of trapped data that people can't get access to now, but they want to be able to use they can't get access to it yet? Data trapped in documents, images, things like that?
Not necessarily data per se. I think it's really the meaning behind the data. I think somewhat it is still trapped, right? At this point, majority of the machine learning that as we see is really trying to look at the data and then try to figure out what they correspond to the outcome and then try to find a mapping between the two, right? There are data, I wouldn't call it data. There are information that's trapped in the data. For example, the concept, right? There are, when you look at various data, if you were able to abstract it and figure out what's the concept that's represented by the data, that can elevate your thinking to a higher level. And at this point, machine learning and AI is starting to help us to uncover those trapped concepts. So I think that if we are able to go to that level, that will be something gonna be a breakthrough, because that potential can enable us to learn with less data, learn to generalize to things much better.
I like what you just said there. That sounds like that was almost a good soundbite or a pull quote or something. We'll have to look back at the transcript for that. That was good. Two more of these questions, and then I will give you a reward at the end for putting up with this. Question number four on the lightning round. What is a truth about data that most people, or let's just say some people, don't realize yet?
The truth of the data is what I buy by is garbage in, garbage out.
Yes.
In a sense that if your data is garbage, even though you say, hey, I spent, you know, $100,000 to buy this data, how come I couldn't get it right?
Yeah.
Because you are not finding the right treasure from the garbage.
Yes. Love that. And then last question. Can you think of a time when data revealed not a new answer, but a new question?
New question about...
Can you think of a time when data kind of, when looking at some data helped you figure out a new question that you should be asking that you didn't think to ask in the first place?
I cannot give you specific examples, but I will say that actually happens quite frequently. Because as you started to explore the data, right, oftentimes you explore the data for specific objectives. But as you started to look at the data, you will realize, hey, you know what? This data can actually help me to solve other problems, right? And I think that does happen in our field very frequently.
Well, Kevin Chen, you've been such a good sport with that last part of the interview, and you've been interesting the whole time. And so I want to give you a little bonus reward at the end here. The floor is yours. Open mic. Whatever you want to say about the work that you're doing, or send people to a website, or encourage people to look up something or think about something, the floor is yours.
All right, so you know, I think being a data scientist, especially at the Experian Data Lab, I'm really privileged to be with Experian Data Lab in the sense that you know, everybody told me the job I have is the best of the world in a sense, because I get to do exploration, I get to do the R&D, I actually get to see my work, my team's work, to be realized to help people, and so I really encourage us to look us up. And then, you know, anything you would like to collaborate, or, you know, you want to find a job at a lab, please reach out to me. I'll be happy to have a conversation with you. Thank you so much.
And there's a lot of guests on our show, including us as well, that would probably fight over all that data science and engineering talent. That's certainly a hot commodity, but definitely understand that I definitely understand the need to pitch that. Kevin Chen, North America Experian Data Labs Chief Scientist. Thanks so much for joining us today on Machine Meets World.
Thank you. Thank you, James. Bye.
And thank you so much, everybody, for watching and listening. Please like, rate, share, subscribe. Let the algorithms know you like the show. I am James Kotecki, and that is what happens when Machine Meets World.